light bulbs on. We are going to discuss launching a new fund in DeFi. And let me invite on the man of the hour, Ash Egan. Ash has been an investor for a long time. I first met him as a part of Accomplice, but just before that, he'd been a part of Consensus and a fund or two previously. We had a talk a couple of years ago, just after I met him, where he sort of talked me through his view of a world that was going to have, you know, more base layer contenders in it. And that would be a conversation that I would think about for some time. I think I've said on this podcast before that I went into 2020 thinking that was going to be like the base layer year story. It was going to be like the Nears and the Harmonies and the Polkadots versus Ethereum all battling out to see who could do the best smart contracts. And that was in no small part informed by my conversation with Ash. It was informed by some other reporting I'd done and just my general interest in that kind of drama, I think. And I also just like the smart contract space. Didn't quite turn out that way, but that doesn't mean that that day will never come. Regardless, since then, you know, Ash has made some more strong investments out there. And I recently reported in CoinDesk, along with TechCrunch and some others, that he's kicked off a new fund called Acrylic, and that is a specific reference to the paint, which I like. So we're here to talk to him about that tonight. Ash, are you on?
We're here.
Hey, man.
Brady, thank you for having me.
Yeah, man, my pleasure.
Acrylic. I love the intro.
Welcome. How are you feeling tonight?
I'm feeling great. You know, super excited about the public launch and, you know, obviously the awesome job you did in covering it and the ability to just share sort of the story. But I think, you know, this is something I've been doing for the past 6 or 7 years, and now very excited to build a firm entirely dedicated to early stage crypto investing.
Yeah. And it's been a week this has been public, right? Is that right?
Yeah. Just about 7 days.
How's the first week as a fund runner been?
I mean, thank God I love doing this. I mean, it's been so hectic, but so fun, you know, building out the portfolio, thinking about the team, building this, you know, platform and refining our theses and, you know, branding it. Just all, it's, you know, you're running an early stage business here. I'm still very much so a startup. And so thinking about a lot of the things of how companies get from 0 to 1, you know, trying to get that jump started with Acrylic, with, you know, obviously a great list of existing investments going into the public launch.
Yeah. Well, congrats. So I just want to say really quickly, we've got some folks joining us here. We got some good folks joining us here. I mean, you're all good folks, but there's some folks I know in here, which I'm happy to see. So, you know, what we usually do on Lightbulb Talks is we kind of talk for a while, sort of whatever feels natural, and then I sort of open it up. Folks are welcome to request to speak anytime, but it might be a little while before I bring you up. Just a note, and I'll try to remember to say this again at the end, but this is a part of the Spacecasts podcast now, so I record these, so we're recording now. If you come on to speak later, it'll be recorded. That'll go onto the podcast, probably. Sometimes I cut them. So just, you know, expect that. I'm letting everyone know right now. So cool. So,
full disclosures, I'm saying everything is not investment advice.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Not investment advice.
All of these are disclosures.
Do your own research, which is always good advice regardless. Yeah, just cause Ash does it doesn't mean you should do it too. You know, I wrote the story about what you have got here. You know, you basically raised some money. You already have a few investments out the door. I want to talk about those. I want to unpack those a little bit more than we did in my story. But first, you know, I have been reporting on investments for maybe just slightly longer than you've been making them. Not really, maybe 7 years. I'm not even sure. Actually, maybe it's like roughly
similar era.
Yeah, right. But the difference is, you know, I don't feel like I feel like I'm only recently starting to get a handle on what just kind of how complicated it is to be a VC. You know, I think people look at it and just like, you got a pile of money. How hard can it be? Like, people want it from you. But so like, maybe we could start there. Like, what is the challenge of running a fund? Because I understand it is easily harder than people think it is. You know, what makes it tough and what don't people get about running one of these operations?
Yeah, I think there's so many different strategies in traditional VC and crypto VC, you know, sort of these hedge funds and sort of the crypto investing world. I think ultimately, though, if you sort of look at best in class investors, are you thesis driven or are you reflexive? Meaning, you know, are you sort of reactive to the things that are coming across your desk? And I think you can have that sort of happy medium between the two. But, you know, if a thesis isn't playing out after a certain amount of time, or you're seeing the market sort of act differently, and that's more to the reflexive side, you know, you have to make adjustments as a firm. But where I'm focusing is at that sort of early stage of sort of protocol company building. And I think this is something that's going to take, you know, sort of years to develop and whatnot. But ultimately, it's about sort of being that first round of investing and not worrying about the ebbs and flows. And so you're going to have so many different other strategies. But, you know, the hope is this entire market is going to grow. And I think there are certain models that are better suited to fit the upside that, I mean, we can talk about all of these, but, and I feel like I'm rambling out here. So I'm going to pass it over. I'm going to pass it back to you.
Well, so, I mean, one thing I think you're saying there that about what makes it hard is there's a lot of ideas out there, and especially if you're trying to get in early with folks, then you're probably even open or maybe even eager to find, you know, a guy who or a woman who has a day job and an idea and a PowerPoint, or maybe not even a PowerPoint. They've maybe hacked up not even an MVP, but just like a pathetically viable product, but they have a conception. So you've got to find those folks, but there's a pile of folks out there also who just are kicking around ideas all the time just because they hope someone will give them a pile of money and then they won't have to worry about cash for a few years. And so I think that's one of the first things is, how do you find people who very few people know about but also have good ideas, right? I mean, how does one go about that?
Yeah, I think for me, sort of what you're really asking is around, you know, sourcing investments, finding the founders that you're backing. I think there's a bunch of ways. You know, I've sort of over the years looked at where the step functions of innovation were. You know, looked at the ERC-20 standard, look at 721, and just looked at sort of the activity around these standards. And so these almost step functions in innovation. You know, the introduction of stablecoins, like what companies are going to get built around that step function of innovation, or that like sort of massive shift here. And so I think for me, it's, you know, angel investing, building connections with some of these companies that are built around these sort of massive shifts in user behavior, in a breakthrough, in a new protocol design, whatever it may be. You know, I think that's where you're going to find the outsized kinds of opportunities. One, companies that can capture these sort of generational shifts. I mean, Ethereum alone, Bitcoin alone, you know, these are sort of these are considered massive step functions of innovation. But, you know, in terms of finding these companies, it's going to be 7 years investing in this space, just, you know, having goodwill with founders and sort of getting referred interesting opportunities and the likes. It might be, you know, other funds that I've co-invested with, you know, have been doing this for a while, so have probably co-invested with every fund in the space. You know, I think I'm seeing even LPs, you know, they've done some crypto stuff in the past, or they've worked with Web2 serial founders, and they're saying, hey, this person, you know, think about starting in the crypto space. It might be, you know, students, you know, being close to these universities, having lived in Boston, you know, having gone to school in New Jersey, so it's, and living it's, in New York now.
A lot of it's just the people network is how you...
It's the people, but it's also sort of tracking these massive shifts of user behavior, you know, these breakthroughs. I think just yield farming alone, right? Like, AMMs, you know, sort of like the unlocking of this potential new market.
So you need your finger enough on the pulse to know kind of like what's moving and what has potential. And then use the People Network to find folks who are doing interesting things in that area.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'd be curious to hear you talk about, I don't know how much you can talk about this, but like this is the other thing which I feel like it's finally sort of started to come clear to me about investors in the last year or two that I didn't really get before. I feel like I'd heard stuff about it, but I didn't really take it seriously. But some folks have sort of talked kind of honestly to me about it. It's just that, you know, even having, you've got a pretty nice size fund to me, at least it seems pretty big to me. And that's great. Congratulations. But like, but there's so much money looking for a place to go out there in the world right now that it actually is it's kind of a battle to get into these rounds, right? If you find something that you're really excited about, probably you're not the only one and you've got to like hustle to get in. That's right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I do think there's something special about being that first term sheet, you know, the first person who's going to price a company, a protocol, whatever it may be. And that I'd say as a core strategy, that's what I'm focusing on. But you're right, you know, and that's been, I think, competitive rounds. This has been something that's happened since, you know, 2015 for me. That's when I started investing in this space. You know, I've taken the mindset that if it's something that's so compelling and you're putting in a non-core check, a smaller check to build out a relationship, you know, you're sort of trying to invest in a company sort of as the process is rounding up and you work your butt off to increase, you know, sort of the capital invest in that company and really help shoulder to shoulder work with these founders. And I think just like the genuinity, being authentic, being an early supporter, just being, you know, just like the outsourced team member, you know, that's the goal. And I think that's where I'm looking to differentiate amongst this sort of swath of crypto funds and the likes.
But just to put it in, like, to really like say it clearly, I mean, it is true, and tell me if I'm wrong, but like there's a lot of instances where investors are like, please let me give you more money. And folks are like, no, this is as much money as you can give me. Right. I mean, that's like, that's like real, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
But I also think it depends.
I just don't think normal people get that, which is like, it just seems wild, you know, sorry, it keeps going, but it just seems wild.
Right, but
you know?
It's the same in, you know, it's not just crypto investing, right? It's
a whole tech scene, right? I mean, this is across tech.
You could expand it to anything sort of venture capital and private equity related.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, that's 100%. There's a lot of capital that's being recycled. You know, it's going to go back into the ecosystem. You have liquidity that's come about. I suspect it's going to, you know, grow the whole ecosystem. It's being, you know, sort of put into these ecosystems. You look at the developer count, you look at smart contract usage, you look at integrations and, you know, Bitcoin as this global reserve asset, you look at Ethereum and, you know, sort of its growing presence there. This space deserves, you know, I think, and then you look at the talent, and I think if you look at the talent, it's outpacing, you know, sort of the size of the capital pool. And in my opinion, the potential opportunity, you know, there's plenty of more capital that could come into the space. I just think this platform, this technology has a larger potential than the internet did.
I agree. I think for you, I'm probably talking about this stuff and it's just like, it seems so in the water for you, but I, you know, it took me a long time to get this. And I have a feeling a lot of regular people also don't get that this is the challenge of venture investing. It's just like, it's a challenge that like, it's just hard for the rest of us to like comprehend, you know, which, it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting framework. It took a long time before it settled in for me. So, okay, cool. So, you know, let's talk your book, because I think that actually is interesting and worth doing. Can you take us through some of your greatest hits? I was just looking at them a minute ago and there's some good things. I mean, I think it's worth, you don't need to do it as sort of bragging. There's just some interesting companies in here, and talk about sort of how, what your thinking was at that moment, you know?
Yeah. Let's go back in time. So for me, in my investing focus on crypto started after reading the Ethereum white paper. I thought smart contracts were just, you know, sort of natively tying compute and value was a fascinating concept, and even just the examples listed. So that's when I was sort of like, all right, this is a space that I need to just absolutely go deep into. Ultimately, invested in Chainalysis at the end of that year in 2015. My thesis, and so this, you know, I didn't lead the round. I think this is a good example of just being a smaller check and working your butt off for these companies. But my thesis was so simple back then. It was, if sort of Bitcoin is going to be adopted as an institutional asset class, it needs a bridge between, you know, regulators, sort of like the traditional system, et cetera, and what's happening in crypto. And that was Chainalysis. This is the seed round back in 15. Went over to Consensys on the venture side. This is 2017. There were these crazy, you know, ICO rounds. There were layer one rounds that were 60 million bucks, 30 to 70 million bucks. I wasn't playing that game. I was looking at, you know, where are people not looking? I was thinking about what's next and all these things. And so met Zach Prince. His sort of thesis was, I'm going to just help all these people who have made a ton of, you know, have crypto wealth and just can't take out cash loans. And it was just a personal, you know, that was sort of something that everyone is asking about. And then I'd looked at the category, but it really wasn't until I met Zach where I was like, okay, this guy's special, and Flory as well. Just that, you know, co-founder combo.
What part, like, we are early 2017 or late 2017?
This is like mid 2017.
Okay. Okay.
This is when the markets were hot, but you know, all of the investors were looking at these massive rounds. And, you know, I think
and they were buying tokens, right? I mean, yeah, it was there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And folks probably know, but just in case, so BlockFi is it's real simple. It's just, you know, you've got crypto that has value. You can post it as collateral and they'll give you a loan. And, you know, in cash, and it's just a lending company. But you know, 2017 is kind of the time at which people started to just be like, oh, holy crap, I can't believe what my Bitcoin's worth. And, you know, it started to make sense to do things like that. And of course, that's also the year that we had the first, well, not the first, but the last all-time high that, you know, really got people talking. So, yeah. Okay. So yes.
And just to paint some, like, just like one layer further, I was at Consensys at the time. And at the point, I think we're at like 1,000 employees. I was like 300. And so it was a period of like, you know, 4 months. We scaled up massively. A lot of people had done very well. And so it was, they caught lightning in a bottle.
And this is a thing, you know, I sort of talked about this at the start of the last episode too, is the virtue of borrowing against your crypto is if you're a believer, like if you're an Ethereum hardcore, you know, you're making a nice income at a place like Consensys or some crypto startup, but you don't have it quite enough to do whatever it is you want to do, you know, buy the house or whatever, but you're kind of on paper rich with ETH or whatever, but you don't want to sell it because you believe, and that feels like a betrayal. Lending is a way that you can get, you know, do something, but you can still hold on to the thing that you believe in, right? It's another part of the value.
Well, yeah, so it started as borrow, then it, you know, then lending and the BlockFi interest account, now the credit card, you know, now obviously they're doing a bunch of other fascinating things.
And this all kind of foreshadowing DeFi too. I mean, this is sort of like,
exactly. Yeah. This was when, so Compound was raising its seed and, I remember really well. It was, you know, should have probably done both investments, but, ended up doing leading BlockFi's round at Consensys.
So just a quick aside on that. I think back on Compound and how important it is now. You know, I did the first story at CoinDesk about Compound. I might have done the first story about Compound. I don't know. But the first story at CoinDesk is about Compound for sure. And, because TechCrunch did it one at the same time. I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Who cares? Well, I mean, I kind of care. But the funny thing about Compound, it was smart on Robert's part, but like Robert Leshner, the founder, when he was talking about it to me and to everybody, you know, he just described it as a way to do shorts. He was like, oh, you can just borrow a token from us and then you can short something if that's what you want to do. And he just kept it really simple in that way because it just to take people back in time, it was really hard for people to comprehend back then that you would really want to like do borrowing and lending in the way that we think about it in the rest of the world. And so he like couched it all in these trading terms, even though I think he was pretty sure it would be bigger than that. because he just knew that people wouldn't understand it, you know? So it was just like, oh, you can, we're a shorting platform. You know, it's just funny to think back on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all of these visions have evolved, you know, from 2017. And I think at that point, you know, Consensus was an incredible experience, made a lot of really good friends. That was such a fun time period. I was sort of thinking, you know, I want to get to a place where investing is the sole focus. And, you know, Consensus was doing a bunch of things, obviously investing being one of those, but
were you doing things besides investing? I sort of thought you were an in-house investor at Consensus.
Yeah, exactly. I was.
Oh, okay.
But that's exactly what it was. But I think it's like, as you think around, what are firms' core focus? What are companies' core focus?
Consensus did not have one at that time. Yeah, right.
Look, I love my experience.
I can say it. You don't need to say it. I'll say it.
I really enjoyed it. You know, I feel lucky to have worked there. But I think I was thinking around like, all right, you know, where can I, you know, where can I ramp up sort of like what I really enjoy doing? I think I wanted to back really ambitious founders, not necessarily building in the Ethereum ecosystem directly, you know, and I think Accomplice was a fantastic platform for the past, and that's, you know, I continue as a venture partner, but over the past 3 years and partnering with a bunch of different, you know, layer ones, DeFi protocols, sort of, you know, supporting infrastructure equity investments. We can run through those, but
yeah, maybe just how about we do Mina and Near, and because those are two are kind of funky and interesting. Why don't you talk about those two?
Yeah, so I think zero knowledge proofs. This is sort of researchers are making breakthroughs on, you know, over the past few months, few years. I mean, it's been remarkable seeing the technology improvements on what you can do with zero knowledge proofs. And that's really what Mina is capturing. You know, they have, I think my thesis across like all of these layer ones back in 18, you know, 19, even in 20 was, is there a differentiated, you know, niche or angle or, you know, sort of way that they're looking at solving this problem of building a, you know, decentralized compute layer. And I saw that in, you know, how Mina was thinking around privacy and, you know, sort of, being a scalable blockchain, like this, you know, succinct blockchain.
Could you say really quickly, like how they do that? Cause it is pretty wild.
Yeah. You're basically using receipts. You know, it's like, you don't need to load an entire history of what's transpired when you actually have the receipts of these things. You can just minimize the size of the actual blockchain into, you know, the size of a tweet.
And it's a crazy thing where if you can, probably the average person wouldn't know how to do this and it doesn't really matter, but like if you wanted to run a proof, you know, like 7 transactions ago, did this guy have this amount? You still can. And the proof would be like, yes, accurate amount, but you don't actually need to hold on to all that data on every node or really on any node. It's the truth of the record is maintained through a proof system. That is, it works through, you know, crazy, you know, hive mind level math, which is super impressive.
Yeah. And I think I just love like the bottoms up, how they've built their community, all these things. It's initially was folks who were just fascinated by what's happening in zero knowledge proofs. And then it grew to, you know, new things that you can do with Mina that you might not be able to do with other chains, like
where is
accessing
Mina at right now? Like I know it's kind of it. I really have failed to continue to report on it like I wanted to. I was interested from the start, but yeah, I mean, I was super interested in it from my first story on it, but it just kind of hasn't happened. But like I know it's sort of live. Or like what is going on right now?
Yeah, so I think just thinking around these blockchain or protocol launches is like different stages, you know, it's like, building out the ecosystem, building out the community, you know, ensuring that you can go through multiple test nets and actually launch and be sufficiently decentralized. You know, I think, thinking around the what are the applications? Like, what can you do with these things? And I think Mina is doing some really fascinating, like the Teller integration, you know, they're talking around the ability to get sensitive information or like your credit, you know, your credit score, whatever it may be, and actually use that for applications and build, you know, just this more, a more internet native kind of application, but that's also, you know, sort of the ability to query more sensitive information because of this zero knowledge proof type format.
But is it fully live or is it like in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And I feel like when I first covered him, they were thinking really in terms of like light mobile level payments because, you know, every wallet could be a node, is that kind of still where they're at or is that evolved?
Yeah, I think that's, if you think through like the application suite, just, you know, Venmo and the ability to run a node on your phone. I think just building out the UI, building out the tooling, building out all these other things is that sort of next chapter and what they're focused on right now.
And people can run like kind of active nodes and earn Mina from doing that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I have a laptop. I have Docker set up. Yeah. We're running it right now.
Oh, you do it. How hard is it?
It's not too difficult.
Okay.
I mean, just like, you know, knowing sort of like command line interface, like knowing simple functions. But look, I think for the more interested, you know, the zero knowledge proof type background or interested folks, they're gonna go through those steps. But I think for your, you know, let's say your average DeFi user who's, it's maybe two steps versus like 18 steps, right, to figure these things out.
Okay.
They're not going to be running nodes tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And then Near, the friendliest blockchain.
So these, like, Ilya and Alex, ex-Google, ex-Facebook, brilliant, just like, you know, and obviously all of these, the Mina team, you know, Near, just brilliant people intellectually. I read their white paper and I just was reading through how they were thinking around sharding and sort of like decentralized, like how do you scale compute? And I was like, oh my God, this is brilliant. So I reached out to them. I was living in SF, but I was actually in Boston at the time, got on the next flight, saw them and was like, guys, like we really, you know, just need to work with you. And they've gone through a bunch of different steps. Obviously, Near is live. They've built the Near to ETH bridge, which I think it's great. Like that's, if you're going to build one of these layer ones, I think just having a bridge, a workable bridge, is, you know, just so key on that checklist. What on Near would be most helpful? You know, like application suite.
The thing that I like about them that I find, well, I always kind of make jokes about it, but I actually do think it is a strategically interesting move that they've made is, you know, I'm serious when I say it's the friendliest blockchain. You know, there, no one in tech ever usually talks too much smack about, no one has any competitors and whatever, but like Near is aggressive in its friendliness. Like it'll integrate with everybody. It says everyone's stuff is great. It only wants to be a compliment in the system. It's not trying to make a big deal out of like, we're better at this, or like, you know, oh, they're really good, but like, you know, here's 75 different concerns about them. That is not in your broader strategy. They love to give a platform to other blockchains. They bring them on their podcast. They do
whiteboarding sessions.
Yeah.
Are like, probably the most informative thing in this industry. If you just like watch all of those, you would be, you know, top 2%, top 5% knowledge, I feel like, in this industry.
So I think that is, it does stand out as a unique strategy. But I guess it would also be helpful to hear from you, like, you know, Ethereum is the dominant smart contract space. You know, why do you think the world also needs Near?
So I think we're early. The pie is going to grow. There are definitely some variables that I have a guess of how it might pan out, but I don't know exactly how it's going to pan out. I'm supportive of development across all of these blockchains, right? All of these public blockchains. You know, we need to get more devs in. We need to get more companies built. You know, we need more activity in all these things. I think we need to explore more use cases, you know, new kinds of applications. But I think let's just look at the numbers right now. You know, the number of wallets, the liquidity on Ethereum, the application suite, the, you know, the sort of the, you know, commodity nature almost of it, just like, you know, the world looking at it as, you know, this is almost on Bitcoin's level, obviously not there yet in terms of maturity and all these things. It's hard to, you know, deny that, ignore it. But, you know, I think it's great to see what's happening on the applications building on Polygon, Near, you know, Solana, you know, all these other areas. Ultimately, you know, are we going to see these chains communicate and the applications and users don't care as much about where it's settled? Is it going to continue to be siloed? Is compute going to go to layer two? Are these looking, you know, are they going to be side chains and et cetera? All open questions. But ultimately, I'm excited to see just more companies, you know, more of these protocols and primitives getting built. But I think right now I'm especially excited about what's happening on Ethereum.
Yeah. So, you know, the thing that has been a little discouraging to me in the last year or so is it does, and I'd be curious to get your take on this, but it does sort of feel like, I may say this a stupid way, but application innovation really seems like it's stopped kind of. And what I mean by that is like, you know, Near and Polkadot and what's the one that Professor Sear does?
Avalanche,
you know, all of these interesting projects run by, you know, super geniuses. Like from what I can tell, they're all trying to be kind of mainly the other NFT chains with a side helping of DeFi, and no one's as far as I can tell really trying to stand out and do. And I don't know what it is, you know. That's not my role, but it's just they're all trying to do roughly the same things. They're just like, oh, we can do it better, faster, more securely, whatever. But it is kind of the same stuff, which is a little bit discouraging to me. I don't know how you feel about that.
I agree. Look, I think if I'm going to invest in applications, protocols, higher in the stack on other blockchains beyond Ethereum, I think it's got to be a net new application, right? It's got to be something you can't do or just a unique way of, you know, building out, sort of obsessed user base and all these things. But I'm seeing a lot of copycats of, you know, sort of name your X protocol, sort of app dApp, all these things for new chain. I think I just personally get less excited about those opportunities. I think it's, you know, about these net new use cases. And I still think there's a ton of low hanging fruit around what you can, even curation, right? Like even depositing dollars and earning yield in a automated kind of fashion, you know, programmable money. That's what a lot of this stuff is. You know, social networks, you know, thinking around just being, you know, an owner of a network that you're using sort of, you know, within local communities, whatever it may be. And so I think there's like a lot of really cool, interesting stuff that we haven't explored as much. And maybe it's on, I don't know what chain it's going to get built on, but, you know, looking at the data, it's a lot of founders are still building on layer one. You know, they're building on Ethereum. They're going to build, you know, across a few other of these optimistic rollups, layer twos. Maybe they go to other chains as well.
The thing that makes me nervous about the fact that I see so much copycat happening on these other, you know, probably really good blockchains is I do, and it could be superstitious on my part, but there's this part of me that thinks that, like, once you go down the copying someone else road, it's really hard to get your head out of that headspace, you know? Like, so that's what makes
me... I think that's just such a short-minded... Yeah, it's sort of like... You want to build for years, right? Like, it shouldn't... you know, bull runs, bear runs, it shouldn't matter. Like, if you're going to start a company, start a protocol, you want to be doing it for years. It takes years to do these things. It doesn't happen overnight. And so I think just like, if it's X for X and you're saying something that other people aren't, you know, it's like the, and then, right? Yes. Maybe there's something there, but you know, I think the copycats alone is just less exciting if that's the end game.
Do you think is there a chain out there that's really trying to, I know this is a thing that was really big at Consensus back in the day, and I don't think they've entirely abandoned it, but I don't think it's in top priority anymore, and it still floats around out there, but it hasn't really taken off. But is there a chain that you see as really trying to do the Web3 thing, you know, to like give us the decentralized web in a way that is convincing to you?
Yeah. I think Web3, I think it's so hard to define right now. Like, is Web3 DeFi? Is Web3 NFTs? Is Web3 the metaverse? Is just Web3 as simple as having a Chrome extension and moving it, you know, across various tabs? I think like the Web3 vision is something so hard to find. I mean, what do you think? How would you define Web3? Because to me, it's like, it's just everything here, right? It's just crypto. Web3 equals crypto.
Oh, I guess to me, Web3 is like publicly available sets of data, but that is encrypted in such a way that only like the data is all out in the open, yeah. But it's encrypted. And which means that anyone who's given permission could build on top of that data. So, I mean, like the easy example to me to give is a Web3 world is when there's this giant data of shit for sale and 47 different UIs of different conceptions of eBays that are making those products available, but perhaps are oriented towards different users or maybe specific chunks of products within that data, but they're all drawing from one common data set. To me, that's Web3, is like there is publicly available data that multiple interfaces can be built onto, you know, relatively permissionlessly, or maybe with like low levels of permission, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I think, look, you look at smart contracts, that's a big part of it. How are people using smart contracts? What smart contracts are getting a ton of usage? And today it's DeFi, NFTs, gaming, metaverse, right? I think it's already happening today across Ethereum and other blockchains. I think it's also cool to see some, like the Dapper Labs team has been brilliant around NBA Top Shot, you know, having done it with CryptoKitties and then doing it again a few years later. And I think just abstracting away a bunch of things for like an early user base and frankly, a more mainstream user base. Like, I think that was huge for the industry and got a lot of folks thinking around, okay, you know, do we abstract more things away for the end user, or do we let the crypto native users, you know, continue to grow, like from an education standpoint? That was cool.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
So I think most of the folks who are on here have been with us most of the time, so that's cool. But just in case you're just joining us, you know, I'm here with Ash Egan. He just launched his own fund called Acrylic. And that name is a reference to the paint because he wants to build layers over time that create an interesting image. I think that's a great conception, but I'm also a fan of analog art. I just want to say to folks, you know, if folks have questions or comments, I don't care. You know, there's always that thing where folks are just like, just please make it a question. I don't care. You can have a comment. It's fine. But if you'd like to speak, you know, just request to speak and I will let you up in just a few minutes. I want to ask Ash about two more things. And then I'd be happy to hear from you. And, you know, let's open the conversation up a little bit. So, Ash, the first thing I want you to just run through really quickly for me is some recent investments you've had. I'm always trying to, like, kind of be ahead of the curve on stuff. And there were a few things on your list that I didn't really know what they were, even though I think I actually have looked a couple of them up before, but I don't remember. So if you could just unpack them. That'd be cool. And the fun thing is they all start with S, Swivel, Saddle, and Syndicate. So just give us the quick rundown of all three of these S's.
Those were personal investments.
Great.
So Syndicate is an acrylic investment.
Okay, I thought so. Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Syndicate Protocol, the three S's, I love it. So yeah, two of these angel investments from prior to founding Acrylic, and then Syndicate being an acrylic investment. Syndicate is building infrastructure for DAOs, making it frictionless to launch a DAO from building an investment club, you know, sort of like a particular focus on, you know, some kind of theme or narrative.
I want to join a weird DAO so badly.
Yeah,
I'm constantly like groups of friends that like be brainstorming something and be like, let's make a DAO.
After that, DAO summer.
They don't know what I mean. Yeah, exactly. They don't know what I mean.
Yeah, living in it.
Quick shout out to myself. Our last session was with Orca Protocol, which is all about DAO governance and isn't quite released their product yet, but is, you know, putting things together. So okay. So those two things, those topics go together. I've been trying to unpack DAOs more on this conversation too. So okay, Syndicate helps you get DAOs started. That makes sense with the name.
Launching DAOs in a frictionless way.
Great. What about Saddle?
So Saddle is a stablecoin curve AMM.
Okay.
You know, they basically allow people to come in, earn yield on their stable coins and have a bunch of different partners and all these things. So brilliant team. But yeah, again, not acrylic, personal investment. Love those guys.
A Curve is a tough operation to stand out from. Do they have a pitch on how they stand out from Curve?
Yeah, I think it's integrations. You know, they're sort of figuring out more attractive ways to attract liquidity, APR, you know, just testing a bunch of different things, but no question is, you know, Curve sort of the gorilla in the room when it comes to stablecoin curved AMMs.
And just a random thought here, but, you know, I say some version of this, I've said it for a very long time, but Curve speaks to me in terms of like what I really like about technology. And I think probably why being an investor is probably kind of cool, but like, you know, when you, especially if you were there when Curve was kind of taken off, you know, and I was around DeFi a lot of the time. It's one of those things where you're just like, why does anyone need this? I mean, because it's like the idea of Curve is that like it's very good at trading things whose value should be roughly the same, you know? And, you know, the founder, why is his name escaping me right now? Anyway, he's talk about a super brilliant guy. I mean, he's like so smart that he has.
Yeah,
he's just crazy. But like he saw this and it turns out there is a lot of demand for doing that.
People and the concept is so simple. I think originally I was like, oh, they're like that. How large can this get? And it just, you know, sort of USDC's growth over the past, you know, few years. You have all these other stable coins, you know, sort of like these synthetics. When there's just an explosion in synthetics, and they've done a great job at being a very attractive source for liquidity and all these things.
Yeah, people need to move in and out of this stuff a lot. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah. I think open question is, you know, are other AMM designs well positioned to capture, you know, other chunks of that balancer? Obviously Uniswap V3 I think is going to be fascinating to see how Curve liquidity flows, especially Uniswap V3.
And let me say the dumbass version of how Curve works, but like other AMM, the sort of the pure AMM model is the price of the two things in the pool are just the ratio of the two things, which, you know, really hurts your head if you think about it too much. But if you're putting things in a pool that are almost always the same value, you can make that ratio. You can make the curve just sort of basically flat across most of the full supply, and it'll largely work out. And so that's sort of what it did. Is just like it. I don't know how it does it, but it's more of a straight line than a curve. It's the curve of curve that like makes those trades a lot more efficient, because generally speaking, you're going to be okay doing it that way. And so, which was a big insight, and it turned out to be a really powerful insight. So yeah, go Curve. Okay. So Saddle is entering that space, and others have as well. So that's notable. And then Swivel, what about Swivel? That's the one I think I have looked up before, but I don't remember.
Interest rate swaps, building an AMM, haven't launched yet, have a testnet.
Okay.
Julian Traversa is the founder, brilliant guy.
So it's a way to trade investments? Like if you...
No, interest rates. So interest rate swaps. So you have like fixed interest rates, you have variable interest rates, you have floating interest rates. Aggregating those interest rates and building a protocol to, you know, provide liquidity across these various rates hasn't been built out yet.
That I guess I don't understand what you're...
So they're aggregating... So you're getting, you sort of have like market data around what an interest rate is. You have fixed interest rates, so you're taking out a loan over a set period of time. You can take out sort of a variable loan, which is, you know, it moves as the market moves and all these things. And then there's deltas. There's differences between what these rates are and their maturities and different platforms that are offering them, especially the fixed rates. These fixed rate loans. And then you have sort of, you can aggregate these rates across all these different protocols, all these different DeFi products, and aggregate it into, you know, a single AMM and interface. And so they will be announcing a bunch of things in the coming weeks.
Sounds like I should that all hurts my head really badly. So I should have him on, and we should.
I love this stuff. Like,
yeah, we should talk that through. Okay, cool. So I haven't seen anyone request to come on yet, but you totally should. But let me ask you. I can have a couple more things I could ask you about, or we can wrap it up. But I don't know how much time you have. But I have to ask you I don't know if you've listened to any of my prior episodes. You probably haven't. That's okay. I won't be hurt. But this
is my second time using Twitter Spaces. I'm loving it.
Oh, great. Okay,
but I'll
cool.
check your stuff out. Yeah.
No worries. Have you been a Clubhouse guy? Have you Clubhoused?
I was going hard on Clubhouse early.
Oh, really?
On. Yeah.
Was it helping you like get through COVID?
I was like, what's up, guys?
Yeah. I had a thing against Clubhouse. I don't know what it was, but I just was like, it bugged me. And but then Twitter did the exact same thing, and I was like, yes.
So I'm trying to split my time nowadays.
Okay. Well,
but
I'm glad
I'll
to
get
be,
more into spaces.
I'm glad to be your second. So this show has a side quest. And I actually am a little bit optimistic about bringing you into my side quest, but we'll see.
Okay.
But I did a story back before I was at CoinDesk in the ICO era about the useless Ethereum token. And it's kind of one of my greatest hits. The UET CEO was very, he was very public for a hot minute while he was doing his, you know, admittedly totally phony and wasteful ICO, which he was doing to make fun of ICOs, but he did really take money out of. And then he, you know, disappeared once it was over, which makes sense, though the website is still up. And I have decided it's this show's mission for me to find out who the UET CEO was. So, and I believe he's still around. That's a thing that I believe. Like, I think he's probably working at some startup or maybe even a founder. I don't know. But do you know who he is?
No idea. I feel like maybe we can torture someone in our listener base and then they'll tell us.
Well, that's what I'm hoping is just one day someone who's listening will like DM
me.
Yeah,
no, we don't even need to. Yeah. I'm sure they would be very excited to share that.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Who knows? Yeah. But do you remember that? UET?
I remember hearing that term, but no, I haven't thought about that in years.
He only raised like $65,000, but $65,000 at ETH in 2017. So I don't know if he held on to even like half of that. He's probably doing great.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But
there were so many stories back then, just like the guy who sold everything and, you know, mortgaged out his house and all this stuff is traveling around the world and just buying more Bitcoin.
Right.
I remember just like hysterical stories.
Yeah. Not so much that of that. One. Well, this guy was great because, you know, like he, for example, had a counter on his site when it was the ICO was going that was like, he showed you how many flat screens he was going to buy at flat screen TVs as, you know, people bid more. And
Oh my God.
It didn't get that much, but it did. I mean, for the amount of work he put in, $65,000, was a pretty good amount. So, okay. Does anyone, we've got requests. Sorry. I was totally lying. Here, I'm going to approve everyone who has requested. And, you know, let's start with Catherine Wu, since I do know her. What's up, Catherine? What do you want to say?
What's up, Kaywo?
Hi, Ash. Hi, Brady. Long time no see.
I know, man. It's a bummer.
Yeah.
Hasn't been conferences. We always high-five you at conferences.
I know. I never thought I'd say I miss crypto conferences, although I will say being in Miami was a lot last month.
Cool. Good.
Okay, so I'm going to maybe give like a softball question, but I feel like it's important because, you know, in the past year, I think every day I'm either like reading about a new crypto fund being raised or, you know, some legacy non-crypto fund now apparently like super interested in crypto and wants to make crypto bets. So obviously, you know, it's a good time to be a crypto founder because there's so much capital and there are so many investors who are now like excited and curious and like open-minded. So the question, I guess, for Ash, you know, which is that like in a super competitive funding environment, what should founders, especially crypto founders, look for in their investors? Or if you're feeling like giving hot takes, what are some red flags in a prospective investor?
Ooh, zinger.
Zinger.
I love it. Yeah. I think the way I thought around building Acrylic was I want to design a firm and sort of start building something that can be that first round of financing, you know, sort of be that first check. It's like, hey, you know, I got you. I'm going to be here for a while and I'm going to help you as much as I possibly can. And I think, you know, just the size 55, you know, sort of being positioned to lead, co-lead, just be a, sort of a check in those initial rounds. It's meaningful for a $55 million fund versus I think a lot of the market, it's hundreds of millions of dollars and all these things, you know, chasing first stage opportunities where you got to prove a few things out or you've already, you know, proved something out or you've written something or you just have a unique sort of way of looking at it. You know, you don't need to raise 20 million bucks out of the gates. I think a few million bucks, if you're going to do that, right? Maybe you want to raise a couple hundred K or something like that. But founders want to work with people who have backed, you know, like the prior wave of founders. You know, they want to back people who they aspire to be like, in my opinion, but in a non-competitive way. You know, they don't want investors who are investing in, you know, everything. I think it's a lot about specialization and all these things and just being designed and, you know, specializing in this stage is what I'm so excited about doing. And I just think that's unique sort of value prop for founders now. And yeah, I'm pumped. We'll see if it resonates.
What about the danger signs side of the question? What makes an investor look dangerous?
I was trying to,
yeah, you can avoid
it. I was hoping that people would forget about it.
Don't like, ignore my question.
I'm like, you guys have blue check marks. Why don't I have one of those? No, I think like when founders are talking about, you know, I'm going to do this and this and this. And it's just like a very, or it's reactive, right? They're relying too much on what they're seeing in the market. Like, oh, I'm going to do exactly this, but change that or not even change anything. You know, I think it's like reactive, founders or, you know, ones that just don't have that are like, it just smells wrong. You're like, oh, I don't like this. And maybe you have, you know, direct evidence on that. But I think like founders with high integrity, you know, and just taking a long-term view is so important. There's so many, like we can talk about the specific red flags, like what they're saying or what they're doing. But I think just generally it's like if people are ill-intentioned, right? I mean, there's a bunch of them. But I think, you know, for the most part, people are good-willed and want to do, you know, good things for the world. But some are short, you know, some are trying to take a, you know, one month, 2 months, you know, just take a shortcut where, you know, it takes years to do these things.
I'm going to go in the order I see, folks. I see Jeff Scott Ward, 0xJSW. What's up? What's going on? Zero
hey,
X. Yo.
Hey, Ash. Good to see you.
What's going on,
yeah? And yeah, thanks for calling me, Brady. You know, well, one, I want to say a great question just before about, you know, who to talk to, because that's exactly what I'm doing right now, is trying to figure out who I want on my team. You know, I definitely have kind of the OG crypto, you know, black book to hit up for sure. And that's kind of my go-to.
The Infinite Machine. Great shout out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I I am that guy.
You were in the book?
Yeah, I was in the book. Yeah.
It's a good book? I like it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Folks who know, it's Cami Russo's book on the history of Ethereum, kind of up to, I don't know, a little after the ICO time. It's a fun read.
Yeah, I was the sort of Mr. Robot character in the book of, like, Occupy Wall Street. And yeah, I mean, like, I literally taught myself to code because the economy collapsed and I freaked out.
Cool. It's like one precarious character.
Yep.
No, I'm just kidding. It was cool to see that.
But yeah, no, I want to say what you said earlier, Brady, about how people are, like, they're all kind of like looking at one source of truth, but then are building experiences for, like, a certain category or a certain type of user.
Oh, the Web3 thing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I'm a Web3 guy. And that is exactly what I'm doing. So,
bang, bang.
So Rarible, you know, they have their, you know, protocol now, as well as, you know, the market that they've already built. And I'm building an augmented reality NFT marketplace on top of Rarible. Because, you know, AR being so new, like, it's such a wide category that, like, you know, you have face filters and interactive and audio and, like, mini game. It's just, like, it's so deep. I was like, this is a whole category no one's even attempted to touch yet.
Yeah. Like Pokemon Go style, or like using your phone, or.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So the phone, and here's the kicker, without a native app. Because there is like Veeve and, you know, some things out there, but I'm trying to get that, like, sort of single, like, was it like time to interactive, like how little, you know, you need to interact with an application in order to get to that experience. And I figured out that Apple has, like, kind of this custom banner button thing you can put right into the AR experience that you can fire directly from the web browser, so you can, like, kind of, you know, projects the augmented reality model, like, and immediately hit the buy button and, like, fire off a Web3
transaction. So is this like you could be in an NFT Walmart anywhere you are? You're just like, if I just want to see a bunch of NFTs right now and, like, walk around and look at them.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Okay, cool. That sounds neat. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, it sort of just illustrates exactly what you were saying, is that, like, you know, NFTs are just a standard, and depending on, you know, what front end you're talking about, you know, you can kind of cater to an entire audience. And actually do maybe have a parlay of a question behind this, is that because I have the design background and then taught myself to code, and then the smart contract layer is handled by Rarible, I am sort of being extremely stubborn in the fact that I can almost literally build out the entire front end myself. But probably could use some horsepower and knowledge in the, like, 3D, you know, tooling and just, you know, that whole space.
Yeah. Like an ex Pokemon Go.
Right. Exactly. So
I'm going to think on that. There's definitely people that could be interesting. I don't know if you're going to find the crypto overlap, but I don't think you have to.
Yep. It's almost like it's really an AR company that uses crypto as a backbone.
Is it Polygon, or are you, like, fronting gas fees, or what are you, how are you building that part?
So Rarible actually has lazy minting, where you can upload the assets to IPFS and not actually have to do anything on chain until someone buys it. So that's, you know, definitely lifted a huge part of this off of my back. But yeah, just as you would.
Super,
you know,
cool. I love it. I'm gonna hit you, Jeff.
Yeah, I DM'd you already because I was saying congrats.
Oh my god!
And yeah.
I appreciate that. I'm, like, doing my best to respond to every. I'm saying, like, 24 hours. I'm responding.
Well, when folks hear this on the podcast, if you've got 3D expertise, Jeff's got some use for you. All right, let's go to a couple other folks, and then we'll probably wrap this up.
I love it. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's go to Chungus Capital, a DeFi team. What's up, Chungus? If I said your name wrong, I'm sorry. Hey there.
Hi.
Hey.
Apologies in advance for the robot voice.
Oh, okay.
I value my privacy greatly.
Yeah, that's great.
I have two questions for you, Ash.
This is great.
First, what are your thoughts on the Oracle layer? I've been reading up on the new Chainlink white paper. And if I'm reading it correctly, they appear to be making a play to go beyond price fees to become the privacy company.
Oh, man. Okay. What's number two? All right. So Oracle layer question. Oracle Dow layer. Has an investment there. I mean, Ash has an investment there. I was going to talk about that, but we didn't get to it. So, okay. And do you want to say the second one now, or do you want to get to that after your response to that? Just go ahead and do it now, Ash. I think, yeah, let's go ahead and do it now.
All right. Chainlink, you know, they've become a standard for oracles. And I think we're going to see a bunch more approaches. I don't know what the particular was it. What was the particular
going beyond? Yeah, what was it? It was going. He was looking at it. Like it was going
NFTs. I think. Well, what was the last part of it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Oh well, so I'm here. Let me. They can reload
computation.
Going to computation. Okay.
I think Oracle. You know, think about what oracles really are. You're bringing off-chain data into, you know, an on-chain environment. How are you doing that? Are you doing a, you know, sort of decentralized way? What are the data sets? You know, what needs to go on-chain? What are the applications? Where does the compute actually go? Where are those sort of queries being settled? And, you know, does Chainlink go down to the base layer, the settlement layer? I don't know. I think, you know, we were talking about Ethereum earlier. And then you talk about, like, you know, Near and Polygon and, you know, some of these other chains that are dev-friendly. And, you know, you just heard Jeff talk about Rarible and building atop Rarible and, you know, sort of building an application directly there. I don't know. Like, I don't have a direct answer. Is Chainlink going to be a competitor? I don't know.
Is it hard as an investor in AP3, API3 DAO?
Yeah.
Is it? It seems I haven't written about it, but I've done a little reporting on this. It seems like it is hard to get clients if your name doesn't end in link. Am I wrong about that?
I think they're doing great. I mean, they have API3 has a ton of integrations. You know, they're working across a bunch of different, you know, sort of sectors and all these things, bringing in the right, you know, bring a bunch of different data on chain, and then having just a community of these, you know, sort of nodes and machines that are running these oracles in a decentralized way. You know, they've done a fantastic job, but I think look at scale, right? You know, API3 is still early days. That was, for context, you know, led the investment at Accomplice, all these things. You know, you look at Chainlink's price and all this stuff, and obviously it's done massively well, and the standards that they've built, and I think they've done some really impressive work there. Will it go to the compute layer? I think it's going to be difficult, but, you know, there's a lot of things that are going to happen over the next few years, so maybe the whole pie grows up, but, yeah.
And Chungus, just because I dig your robot voice, what do you have your second question ready? No? Okay. Well, let's go to... All right. Last one. I'll check back with Chungus in a second, but let's go to Clockwork Rainbow. Ordained Dudist Priest. What's up, Clockwork?
If you need a Dudist wedding, I got you.
All right.
Thanks for having me on. I'm a founder, or I'm looking to be a founder. So in that regard, I've got two questions for you guys. The first is, what do you think about the future of true credit, under collateralized lending, true debt being issued on chain? And second, you know, as a young founder, what would your, I guess, top advice be as when it comes to raising or when it comes to building out? What does an MVP even look like in this space? Just a few concerns confusions I've always had. So,
okay, so founder in the space, and then we can get to the first one.
Sure.
Yeah, I think like things to look out for. Like, I think you want to surround yourself and you want to work with people that love what they're doing and that you can really vibe with, right? I think purely working with people that, you know, you're from a resume standpoint, like makes sense. I think that's just the wrong way to think around things. I think you want to approach problem sets in ideally an unbiased manner, and then figure out where you develop biases and, you know, where you get excited, and obviously sort of looking out for market needs and, you know, sort of new behavior and all these things. And then I'm assuming that relates to what you're building. And I think like, under collateralized loans is something that no one has in the crypto native sphere has necessarily figured out. Right. So yeah, I think it remains an unsolved massive type use case. So I think
if I wanted to get in touch with you regarding this, regarding like startup, what would be the best way?
Twitter DMs.
Just Twitter DMs. Okay. Thank you.
I'm responding. Yeah.
You and I are just the opposite. You know, it never ceases to blow my mind. I have my entire bio is just my email, and people still constantly DM me, and it makes me.
Also works. I'm on email, ashertacrylic.co. You know, emails are always open, either one.
It's great that you're open. So we've got a couple more requests out there. I think I'm going to cut it off, though. I like to keep these at about an hour, and we've gone a little bit over. Thanks a ton to Ash for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Brady.
I think this was a great – I had a good time. Hopefully you did, too.
Yeah, I enjoyed this.
Yeah, we covered a lot of grounds. I feel like there was some good insights that came out. So I got to learn about Swivel, so that was cool for me. For folks listening, I try to do these every Tuesday and Thursday. That has been a little – off of late because I was moving, and it's going to continue to be a little bit off. My next one is actually tomorrow night. That one could be a little bit spicy. If you were interested in the Web3 side of this conversation, I'm going to be talking to Mark Nadal, who's the creator of GUN, the database for freedom fighters. And Mark is really anti-crypto. He thinks a decentralized web is fantastic, and the last thing it needs is tokens. So we had a private conversation about that a while back, and I wanted to talk to him more a little bit publicly. So if you like the Web3 conversation,
yeah, show up for the Q&A.
Show up for that one. Yeah, because it'll be really interesting. But thanks everyone for being here. This will be on Spacecasts in the next couple of days. A lot of their good podcasts on the Spacecast feed as well about all kinds of interesting topics in tech. So you should check out those others as well. Thanks to Ash. Thanks to everyone who listened. Thanks to folks who asked questions. And I will see some of you hopefully tomorrow night, and the rest of you on the feed as time goes on. Peace.